Hello and welcome to another episode of Radio Free Nintendo. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz, and with me as always are James Jones.
Always and forever.
And Guillaume Veillette.
Yes, I will take credit for that Amiibo tap prediction.
You should. And John is on travel this week, so taking his place in the guest chair is returning favorite Mr. Donald Terrio.
Just want to pour one out for my boys at the Future Shop. Oh. Too bad you guys missed another Amiibo wave.
I want to point out that GameSpot should really just get after GameStop. Should get after Nintendo for just denial of servicing their own point-of-sale system.
Hmm.
That's amazing. That's amazing that a fucking Jigglypuff Amiibo crashed a multinational company's point-of-sale system.
And that's it for our Amiibo talk.
He pushed down B on those servers. Well, everybody, we have a whole lot to talk about this week. By the way, I didn't really give Donald a very adequate introduction. This is new staff member to Nintendo World Report, Mr. Donald Terrio, who you also know as a co-host of the Nintendo Free Radio podcast that we'll try to talk about a little bit later. Well, a lot bit later in the show. And of course, you know him from the past couple of years. He's hosted a telethon segment, and he also runs the NeoGAF thread for RFN. So Donald, very big friend of the show, and it's been a while since we had you on the regular podcast, I think. So it's very good to have you back, sir.
Glad to be back, and always fun to podcast this late at night.
Yeah, it is late for you. Sorry about that.
We're just starting, bro.
This is a transcontinental show most weeks, and especially this week, I suppose. So
we like
anyway,
a railroad up in here.
We really do have a whole bunch of stuff to get through, and we're going to try to keep it at a brisk pace this week. We're going to start with a feature discussion of the Nintendo Direct announcements. Not all of them, but we'll pick and choose and try to hit the highlights. And then we've got a little bit of new business to catch up on, just so we don't get too far behind on some of the games that we're playing. And Donald has a good one that he wants to talk about that I want to make sure we represent. And then we're going to try to do some listener mail also, because there was so much news even outside of the Direct that we need to do some listener mail just so we have a chance to talk about some of that. So it is going to be a packed episode. And with that, let's get started. So first up, we're recording this one day after the epic Nintendo Direct announcement.
It's Thursday.
We're doing this on the Thursday. So we've had a little bit of time to digest, but there was so much to this thing. It's a little bit hard to know where to start. And what I made kind of a short list here of some of the topics of the Nintendo Direct. And again, we're not going to get to all of these, but I kind of wanted to have the panel here pick and choose one or two things a piece so we can briefly touch upon them. So who wants to go first?
Well, Puzzle and Dragon, right? That's the big one.
No, we can skip that one.
Damn it.
Yeah, well, I'm pretty glad that we finally saw Shin Megami Tensei X-Cross Fire Emblem. We've been waiting. Well, like they did even like draw attention to the fact that they announced this in January 2013. So it's been a long time coming, and I think it's the first time that we see anything about it.
Yep. So the only trailer we've gotten was some static images from other games. It wasn't even art created for these games. And if you look at this trailer, you can see those were not art created for this game.
Yeah, this game has its own look to it for sure. And by the way, they did not actually call this Shin Megami Tensei X-Cross Fire Emblem this time.
No, they said this was the game that was referred to.
It's the crossover between the those two series, but yeah.
So we still don't have a title.
It's probably a U.S. versus Japanese naming thing, because the cross thing doesn't really work as well here as it does in Japan, obviously.
Yeah, that would be wise for them to choose a different name.
My immediate takeaway is that the trailer they showed was cut together like it was the trailer for the newest, you know, shonen anime on Tokyo Broadcasting System. I mean, this thing is anime turned up to like 11. It's not what I expected.
Well, Fire Emblem has some anime tendencies, but
not like this.
Frankly, what I was surprised is that this doesn't look anything like. I recognized very little Fire Emblem in what we saw.
So the classes are like these hyper modernized, you know, versions of Fire Emblem classes, and like so when they have the Pegasus Knight at the end, you see her fly the Pegasus, then turn into a jet Pegasus, which I'm all on board with. But some of the actual combat they showed, which is pretty sparing. They showed a lot of what looked like, you know, super move animations, but they did show some combat that looked distinctly Fire Emblem-esque. You know, the animations.
Really, I didn't get that sense. It looked to me, I don't know what Shin Megami Tensei games look like when you actually play them, but it didn't look like Fire Emblem. I didn't see a grid. I didn't see
No. I mean the actual, like, when you have the fight where the two characters actually hit each other. There was
like
there were the big bombastic animations, but then there were a couple that were interspersed where it was just like character winding up and then just smacking the crap out of another character model.
Well, what do our other two Shin Megami Tensei fans think of this?
Well, the look is different from what I expected, but I guess I should have seen it coming. Like, it's more colorful, perhaps. Persona is a sub-series of Shin Megami Tensei, and that's always been colorful, but...
It's not.
It's kind of a spin-off, maybe.
And that, in Japan, they're not related. They're just... They share some art, they share some, like, monster classes, but they're not...
Right. Well, yeah. To me, that's... Yeah, that's a spinoff. That's the same demons, the same kind of stuff going on. Yeah, sure, it's Shin Megami Tensei. But yeah, so no, it looks cool. Like I really don't know what to expect. Like there's like this classroom setting. You're playing as teenagers. This is all very Shin Megami Tensei-esque. It's very Japanese RPG-esque. I guess I need to see more, but I'm probably going to buy this.
I mean, Bill described it as there's the real world and then there's the fantasy world. Bill being Bill Trennan, Mr. A New Challenger is approaching shirt, which...
Yeah, but that sounds very Persona.
Sure.
I was honestly looking for more of the Fire Emblem references. Like, I think there's a scene where Lin is an idol singer now.
Yeah. Well, if that is Lindis, yeah. I mean, I'm not sure that's who that is. It could be.
If it's not, it's definitely meant to evoke her, but...
Yeah. Yeah,
pardon the pun.
Well, I mean, so she's a student, and then I guess her fantasy is to be an idol, and that's like because there's some weird like shonen or magical girl transformation stuff happening in some of these videos where they like they'll be a student and then they'll transform into some whatever the hell they are. It's this weird game. This trailer is really weird.
It's personally astonishingly weird.
Yeah, personally, I'm glad that there's not too much Fire Emblem mucking up the sanctity of Shin Megami Tensei.
I don't think there's any sanctity left in this trailer. It's even down to the J-pop intro theme. It's infectious.
I don't know if you guys. I thought of FFX2. Like, it looks kind of fan servicey.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, there's a lot of cleavage. That's for sure. Mm-hmm. I think mostly I'm excited because, you know, last week I talked about playing Devil Survivor Overclocked. I said I wasn't sure if I was going to stick with it through the end, but I'm still playing it. I've played it a lot. I'm really enjoying it. And we've discovered... No, I know. But we've discovered that the director of Devil Survivor is directing this. I think that's good news.
Yeah, that's interesting because Devil Survivor is yet another spinoff of the main Shin Megami Tensei series.
Yep,
I'm excited about this game because it exists. I actually am kind of all on board if they just want to make this thing as Japanese as shit. Like, just go crazy, like do it. I don't care. Make it happen. I want that in my life. And you know, it looks really good. Like, it's a really pretty looking game. Like, I'm pretty on board with this now. Like, I worry it's going to be a long time before we hear anything else about it. But makes me feel good.
We'll probably see something on it at E3. Although I think they only announced it as a winter 2015 game for Japan. They didn't give a date for North America. And of course, this being an Atlas game, God only knows when it's going to come out in Europe.
Yeah, I would assume that Nintendo will probably handle the releases outside of Japan. If they're not handling them in Japan, because they have the resources to make that thing happen quick that Atlas may not have. And for Nintendo, it's big this game, get out ASAP.
Yeah. I suspect that Nintendo is publishing this game in the way that they did for Bayonetta 2, for instance. But they did note, Bill Trennan mentioned on the direct that Atlas is making this, and he also referred to it as an RPG, which I doubt that they would do that for a straight Fire Emblem game. I don't think they would call Fire Emblem an RPG without any kind of modifier.
They did later in the segment when they discussed, you know, fans of RPGs. Then he went and showed Fire Emblem Awakening and Bravely Default.
Yeah, I guess that's true. It's weird because I don't really think of Fire Emblem as an RPG.
Oh, they're totally RPGs. I mean, they're strategy RPGs, but they're RPGs.
It's a very particular flavor of that. But yeah, well, let's not split hairs over genre classifications. Donald,
it's a parlor game.
Donald, what looms large for you on this list?
Big thing for me is Fatal Frame 5 is actually coming to the West finally.
Oh, I thought that was 4. Is it 5?
It's 5.
It's 5.
I know they skipped a couple.
Cinco de Framo.
The one for Wii presumably never will come out in the West. But a lot of people thought the Wii U game wouldn't either, especially with, you know, with the previous one having stayed in Japan.
This is the first one.
Did the Wii one come out in Europe?
No.
No. Okay.
This is the first one that Nintendo was the rights owner to when it came out, though. Because remember, they bought the Fatal Frame license for some reason.
Well, there's also Spirit Camera, James. Lest you forget.
This is the first one that's come out since they bought the license.
Are you just pretending that doesn't exist?
This is the first one that came out since they bought the license.
You know, it does look
Spirit
really cool,
Spirit Camera
though.
Was a mistake.
I mean, I've heard fairly good things about it out of Japan, but you know, you don't hear that much because it's kind of a niche franchise even over there. But it looked really – I was surprised that the graphics were as impressive as they are.
It's – like I said, what I've read about the game, yeah, it's cool. It does look really nice. I'm curious how the hell you localize this game because it's pretty weird. How do you sell this game?
Well, you just did what they did on the PlayStation.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, that was a little bit easier on the PlayStation 2, though. It's just like, whatever, we'll put out Mr. Mosquito. We don't give a shit.
I want to say that Fatal Frame 1 and 2 just hit PSN. You can download those now. So that might be worth some people checking out.
For your hot ghost camera action.
Yeah. I've heard they're fantastic games. I've never played any of them. Mm-hmm. So maybe this will be the one.
I assume it kind of works like Pokemon Snap, but with ghosts.
I mean, you're not on a rail. It's survival horror more than anything.
Yeah, and I think the biggest thing that stood out for me was just the reaction, just from being able to briefly glance up at like Twitter during that part of the direct and seeing people like Patrick Klepek completely losing their minds that this is finally coming over. But I suppose with Zelda delayed, you got to have something new for the fall, and this would be just as good a thing as any, I guess.
It's one of those games that the people who are aware that it's not here are super aware that it's not here. So when you bring a game over like that, you make those people like extraordinarily happy. But like everybody else just doesn't give a shit. Like you put it in front of them, like, oh, okay, and then they forget that game, like.
Three days later. there's definitely a built-in word of mouth factor here because it's an acclaimed series and certain people really love it. So
it's been denied to us for so long.
Yeah, it was really quite a shock that they'd be releasing it this year. I think it's a smart thing. I mean, you know, you need to beef up your Wii U schedule.
Yeah, is it really a shock? They've got nothing else.
I kind of looked at it like, well, I guess you kind of had to, didn't you, Nintendo?
Yeah.
I prefer to be a little more, I guess, positive about that. There have been many opportunities for them to do similar things in the past that they chose not to, and in this case they're choosing to do it, and I'm thankful for that. I don't know if I'll get the game. I have to see more about it, but seems like probably around Halloween is kind of the obvious. They said later this year, but
release
I feel like
it
Halloween
December,
probably
just
makes
totally
a lot
screw
of
up
sense.
Everything.
Yeah, it's the big Christmas release. all right. Well, speaking of things that that a very few people here in the West know about and got excited about when it's referenced, let me talk about Smash Brothers for a minute. This was the big intro to the direct and
that niche title.
Yeah. Well, you know, they start off with Mewtwo, which wasn't really a surprise to anybody because we knew that was coming soon, mm-hmm. and sure enough, it is, and here in just a couple of weeks, I am. A little mystified at the pricing for that DLC. Not that I'm going to have to pay it, because I bought both versions, and so I should get it for free if Club Nintendo worked as it's supposed to. But wow, $4 for one character. You know, I know there's a lot of work that goes into balancing these characters, and in a way, it's probably easier to make characters in a big batch rather than do them one at a time after the fact. But if you think about the number of characters that are already in that game and what you get for just the price of the game initially, I feel like adding one character at $4 is or $5 for to get it on both platforms. I don't know that that's a real great value proposition for most people. I mean, unless Mewtwo is your favorite character, you know, if you think about the pricing for like Mario Kart 8 DLC by comparison, it feels like you get much more for your dollar in Mario Kart.
But
and it's hard to compare because they're completely different kinds of games. But
I
feel like, you know, playing those, you know, 8 tracks on Mario Kart for what, $6, not to mention the new characters and stuff, I feel like I'm going to get a lot more enjoyment and spend a lot more time with the game based on that content for less, you know, for about the same price, versus, you know, play with Mewtwo a few times. And I guess now he might show up occasionally online. It's a really weird proposition to me. But anyway, that bit is irrelevant, I suppose, in that, you know, many, many, many of us will get that part for free. But then they kind of surprised us by announcing – well, they definitely surprised us by announcing that Lucas is coming in June. And Lucas, of course, was in Brawl, the Wii version of Smash Brothers. And he's a kind of a NES clone, but he's a little bit different. He has a few differences in his moves and everything, and he looks cool, looks different. But, of course, he's from Mother 3, and they intro'd him by referencing Mother 3 and then I loved on Twitter after the fact, Nintendo said, hey, it's Lucas from Mother 3. And then there's a bunch of replies on Twitter from people saying, what's Mother 3?
Yeah, well,
it never came out here. It's never been released in English anywhere. And
legitimately, anyway.
Yeah, legitimately. You know, Lucas, I'm glad to see that they're doing more characters. There's going to be a ballot where they're going to let people – that seems like a disaster waiting to happen.
Well,
but they're going to allow – I feel like it's kind of an illusion of input.
Yeah,
I kind of feel like they've already decided.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if they've got a large list and they'll use that to whittle it down a little bit. But, like, I mean, there have been some out there that – or maybe they use that – to prioritize. So if they see they've got their largest list of ones they can do and they see that one of them is just hitting constantly, maybe they say, okay, we'll announce that one in conjunction with this other one that we think might need the boost. Or
here's what I could see. They're working on 3 characters. They're going to make those 3, but they're all coming along around at the same pace right now. And maybe they use the survey inputs to figure out which one to finish first or something like that. But I, you know, if you think about the amount of time that it takes to make these characters by their own description, I feel like they're not going to hear about some character in the survey that they never thought to do before, that they never really took as a serious option, and then start working on that from scratch. And then 6 months later, hey, guys, I really doubt that that's the case.
So I think where that could come into play, though, is if it's a character they've already made a Wii U game for and they already have the model data. And that
could help, yeah.
So, like, one I've seen come around a lot is Wonder Red. I've seen a lot of people pushing for that one. Which, okay, you've got the model data for it.
Or Bayonetta. Probably.
There's no freaking way they're going to put Bayonetta in Smash Brothers.
I don't see why not.
You've got a better shot of seeing, like, the character from MC Kids in Smash Brothers than Bayonetta, unfortunately.
Yeah, it would be difficult to do that character justice without doing some things that threaten the sanctity of the T rating.
Okay, the sanctity of the T rating. Well, anyway, one thing I wanted to note about Lucas, which, again, Lucas is much more obscure than Mewtwo.
Oh, yeah.
Either in general or even as a Smash Brothers character. Because, of course, Mewtwo was in Melee, the most popular game in the series. So he's, you know, and he's been around much longer in that franchise. So he's a much, much more popular character. I feel like if they're going to try to charge people $4 or $5 for Lucas, they're going to have trouble selling that to more than just the really hardcore, like, tournament players or whatever.
It's not a matter of how much a thing costs to make. It's a matter of how much they think they can get for him.
Yes.
At least in the opening salvo. Because here's the thing with DLC, there's no cost to dropping the price later.
Sure. Yeah.
So or bundling them together later. Like, hey, we're about to release Series 2 DLC characters. Now you can buy Mewtwo and Lucas together for $6.
Yes.
And today has proven that the kind of people who would care about Lucas, they'll do just about anything to get him in the game to begin with.
Yeah, they're nuts.
Yeah, sure, but they're a very, very small group of people. And just to wrap up my thought about the DLC pricing for Smash Brothers, I feel like with Lucas in particular, there's an opportunity there to spice up the package a little bit. It seemed like they were almost hinting they were going to do something with Mother 3, but I think this would be a fantastic time to release that on the Virtual Console for Wii U and package that download with the Smash Brothers character. And that way you can introduce a whole bunch of people to that game, but also you kind of help justify and smooth over the pricing situation with a character that most people, even Smash Brothers players, I don't think really care about Lucas that much.
Oh, but so, would Nintendo really miss the opportunity to sell a GBA ROM for $12 to the really, really hardcore fans? Because they sold Earthbound was $10.
They'd still have to translate it, though.
Yeah.
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 Well, and they clearly haven't committed to that, but by June, I feel like, maybe by then they... Anyway, I think it's a possibility. Hmm. It'd be a smart way to handle that situation.
One thing that, to me, I do think the balloting could actually do some feedback, depending on how long they intend to keep this thing going. So, I mean, they put the end date on this in, what was it, October? The end of October was, like, the closing date for the voting. Like, they could be planning on doing two or three series of DLC at that rate. I mean, they could be dropping DLC all the way in December. I mean, what if they put out DLC every couple months, and then for Christmas time they released the complete edition?
Said, all right, game of the year or whatever.
Yeah, here it is. If you don't have Smash Brothers, here it is. It's got the new six or seven characters, all the Mii costumes and whatever else they're going to release.
I mean, none of us would be surprised if Smash Bros. Became a pack-in game for the holiday season.
Yeah, oh, absolutely not.
I think it'd be a brilliant move, frankly. Yeah,
that'd make a ton of sense.
Yeah. All right, well, let's move on to something else. James, what do you want to pick out of this list?
Going last means I lost a lot of the big ones. Can I just do Fire Emblem SMT again?
No, you could do the other Fire Emblem if you
want. I guess I could do the other Fire Emblem. This is a weird one. So yeah. We knew this game was coming, we knew there was, you can control the flow of the story, the idea basically being you get to make a decision deciding which way you want to run your, I don't want to say campaign, but like you pick what side of the war you want to be on. Except in the Japanese Nintendo Direct, that's not entirely true. So in the Japanese Nintendo Direct, they announced there are essentially two SKUs of this game. There is a SKU that contains one story, and there is a SKU that contains the other. The story you don't have is DLC for the one you do. So on top of that, there is a, I want to say it was digital-only version of the game that has both, and then around like mission six, it just basically just straight up asks you which way you want to go, because the first six missions are the same.
Yeah. So if you buy it digitally, you have to choose, and then you're locked into that one for the rest.
For the rest of that playthrough.
The digital
SKU that has both.
Uh huh.
You pick your play for that playthrough and then you proceed. It's not like a one time.
So you could start a new file and then go the other way.
Right. Yeah. So the other two SKUs are, it's locked in, and then you buy the DLC to get the other chapter.
Very interesting.
It's interesting.
Seems gimmicky. I mean, it seems like
super gimmicky.
If they could do that on the download version, they could probably just do that on the physical version and just have both campaigns on there.
So, and they describe the two versions. One is, like they say, one of them is a more traditional Fire Emblem approach. By the way, I do like that the Japanese inspired kingdom is always the peaceful one, because that mirrors Japanese history super well. Japan, just tell that to the Koreans you've invaded three times. But the and then the Western ones are the, what they call them, the glory hungry. It's like, oh, come on, guys. Telegraph this a little bit less egregiously. Could you please? But beyond that ridiculousness, there's actually, according to the Japanese one, a third DLC campaign.
Right.
That they didn't really talk much about. But this one, no matter what SKU you buy, that's additional DLC. My guess is there's no way in hell they will attempt to release two SKUs of this game in the retail space in the US, and neither of them include the full game. My guess is we're going to get a retail build that's based on the third option, came out in Japan.
The digital version.
The digital version that has everything.
Right.
And then the DLC will just be that third campaign. Which, why is this so freaking confusing? Like, what the hell, Nintendo?
Yeah.
I mean, there's no reason for this.
It's bizarre. But, I mean, certainly in Japan, the last one, Awakening, was a huge, tremendous hit.
It blew up everywhere, but in Japan, it was nuts.
It was, yeah, extremely successful in Japan. It exceeded expectations everywhere else. But yeah, I mean, clearly they're betting the farm on this in Japan. And, you know, when you consider all the big 3DS games that have come out since then, because that game was 2 or 3 years ago in Japan, it was quite a while back. So it's been a while, and the install base is much larger now than it was back when the last one came out. So they might be looking at having a big hit on their hands. It certainly seems like they're kind of setting it up that way.
That's a lot of game. I mean, another game that did this, where basically you do a couple missions and then it splits down the middle. Front Mission 3 is a lot of game. And I'm just thinking, like, okay, so Fire Emblem Awakening took me about 20-ish hours to clear. If, let's say they're roughly the same, and although they're saying that the two play somewhat differently, that the Western-inspired kingdom is harder, it's a little bit less of a traditional, you play a little bit less traditionally. Let's say they both take 20 hours, it's 40 hours a game, and then you're telling me there's a third campaign I can download?
Yeah.
God!
It's a big-ass game.
That's a lot of game! That's a lot of game!
Mm-hmm.
I'm glad that there's two different storylines, because I'll be the one who's playing the easier one, and my roommate, who plays Lunatic Plus Classic mode on Awakening, will get the harder one.
Yeah, like I'm a little bit torn on that. Like, I want to play the harder one, but I suspect that if I do that, it'll ruin the easy one for me. So I might have to play the easy one first. It is noteworthy. This was one of the first, if not the first, depending on what region you're in. Games that had Fire Emblem Awakening. It was games that Nintendo did with DLC. So it's interesting that they've gone full hog on this one. They're just like, DLC everywhere. Let's just do this.
I'm not into Fire Emblem, so I might skip this. I'm just wondering.
Three Fire Emblems.
Yeah, maybe not. At this point, I'm just wondering when they're going to announce that some Pokemon you can catch in one version can only be found in that version and transfer to the other one.
Yeah.
Mm.
Delivery on that one could use some
work. If they hook Pokemon Bank into the new Fire Emblem, I'd be down.
Yeah, you can transfer your Venusaur to your Fire Emblem game. God. You know, actually though, Nintendo's not done the double skew in a while, with the exception of Pokemon. Like, there was time during the GBC to GBA where, like, everybody was like, oh, we can do two skews of this game and just make it a different color, it'll be fine. Idiots will buy it. Like that's really dropped off. It would be curious if they would ever consider doing something goofy like this with a Pokemon game. Probably not, because they feel like they can get you to double down. But with the advent of the online trading system that they have now, it does sort of diminish the need to double dip, because you can find somebody online willing to trade their version exclusive for your version exclusive pretty easily.
Right.
But if it's... I mean, it would... Would I pay for the opportunity to just be like, I can just get whatever the hell I want? Yeah, sure, why not? I don't know. It does sort of lead the way for any future installments in the series, I guess. But I mean, it looks nice. It still looks nice. It looked nice last time we saw it. It looks better this time than it did last time. I thought last time there was a little bit of jankiness in the graphics.
Yeah.
But it does look pretty good.
Well, guys, I'm going to suggest that we table the Amiibo news, because there's a listener email about Amiibo, and we are going to talk about Amiibo for once on the show.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to at least briefly mention the addition of N64 and DS games to the Wii U Virtual Console. I thought this was very interesting that they would announce this, having, you know, only a couple months ago launched the service of Wii games on Wii U being available in the eShop, and they did those first three, you know, discount promotional games, and then there's been not a word about it since then. Now, in Japan and Europe, both, they've been at least, I think there might have even been subsequent releases, but they've at least announced that there are more games coming, and they've even said which games they are. And it's some of the things that you would probably find kind of interesting, like the kinds of games that maybe you skipped last time. and you'd like to catch up on. In America, there's been not a word of that, and I kind of wanted to wait to pass judgment on it today until today because I thought, well, you know, maybe on Thursday for the normal download eShop thing, maybe they just kind of nonchalantly drop a few in there, but still nothing. Instead, they are adding even more platforms that they may or may not continue to support with additional releases.
Let me take a quick poll of the room. Who here was really waiting to play Mario Kart DS on their Wii U?
Without online working as well.
Without online, yeah.
Not even local. I mean, there's no multiplayer in that game.
Who is going, you know, the Wii U really could turn things around if it had a 10-year-old Mario Kart game that has no multiplayer now on it?
Yeah, well, it had some sort of, not adventure mode, but you had these challenges,
challenge,
right?
Mode. Yeah. It's not even remotely a campaign.
No, I know, but it was something. It was single player content.
Yeah, it's something other than just Grand Prix, but it ain't much to it.
And, God.
Anyway, that aside, we've talked about DS games being remade, you know, made available, and obviously I would vastly prefer to play them on 3DS, but them coming on Wii U isn't a tremendous surprise because there was that Brain Age experiment in Japan last year. Where they had put that out there. I think it might have even been free or very, very cheap. And so we knew that they were kind of experimenting with putting DS games on the system.
Yeah, and, Brain Age was free in Japan and Europe as well. And Europe's also getting Sin and Punishment and Pandora's Tower for Wii this month, whereas, like you said, North America gets crickets.
Well, I mean, we may get those too. There hasn't been a word about them. So
we're getting the Great Amiibo Famine instead.
I just wish that Nintendo would rally a little bit more third-party support before announcing these things. Like, I would like some sort of commitment from Sega. Yes, we will release Field of Magic for this thing, or Sonic Rush, or whatever. Whatever you're into.
Hey, Sega, give us Infinite Space. I want the rest of the world to suffer like I do.
I want Mega Man ZX Advent. Like, come on,
Capcom.
Oh,
the game no one can get? Yeah.
Just give it to me.
That's a good idea. Like, how about the games that nobody can freaking find on DS?
We need Square on any virtual console, but, you know, they'd be really good to have on DS and, well, Super Nintendo.
Absolutely.
But we've also got Donkey Kong 64 coming out, which...
I thought I had died when that came on the show. I'm like, are you really showing me Donkey Kong 64 right now?
Well, it's an N64 game that they did not release on the Wii, and I'm pretty excited. I've never played it, so I want to experience the horror. I want to experience Donkey Kong.
Guillaume, I will send you $10 to buy Donkey Kong 64 just to hear you talk about it.
It's not a matter of experiencing the horror. It's a matter of just the grinding monotony of, oh god, I need 11,479 bananas to feed this fat freaking elephant so I can get through the damn door.
It's not fair to say that Donkey Kong 64 killed the 3D platforming genre, but it tried.
Yeah, it said, you know.
And I say that as I'm the guy who had like all 205 golden bananas or whatever the fuck. I played every inch of that game, and I regret it deeply.
Yeah.
And I will never go back to play it again.
It's dumb garbage like, oh, you need to get the pink bananas, but only the girl can pick up the pink bananas. So get your ass back over there and play as her so you can get the damn pink bananas. Like, I don't want to do this.
Yeah.
So, but
you know what, Guillaume? I had not considered that, but you bring up a really interesting point. This is a game that never came out on the Wii Virtual Console. So it does open up the doors for different things to
more
come out.
More exciting games, yes. I would prefer if they had showed Excitebike 64, but
hell yeah,
we're gonna have to make do with this, you know.
I do like that this is like 2 weeks after the guys over at Playtronic when they were discussing what makes Banjo-Kazooie work, like Donkey Kong 64 crickets.
But of course Super Mario 64 is already out. That's a wonderful game. I mentioned it on last week's episode. I'm very glad to see that, and I thought I had... You can upgrade if you own the N64, if you own the Wii version, a virtual console of these N64 games, you can upgrade them for $2, which is nice that they're continuing that program. And I thought I had bought that on Wii, but apparently I hadn't, which opens up the horrifying possibility that I haven't played Super Mario 64 in a very long time. So I might have to drop my $10 on that. I'm very curious.
Could that have been something you might have lost in the flood, though? Like, it might have been on your old system and you just didn't get a chance to carry it over?
No, because I got all my accounts restored, or my games restored.
Okay. If you got any Club Nintendo coins left, it's on the Club Nintendo catalog, so probably grab it there as well.
No, I spent all my coins. That's interesting, though. That's a good PSA for everybody listening. If you want to download it for a couple hundred coins on Club Nintendo, then you could go pay $2 to upgrade it to your Wii U. You don't ever have to download it on the Wii at all. So that's a nice thing that you can do that. So I do love N64, and I always felt that that library on Wii Virtual Console was particularly anemic. We very rarely saw releases on it. They showed in the reel that they're doing Paper Mario as well as DK64, and I think one other thing. I don't recall off the top of my head right now, but. I would love for them to continue this, and especially if they're going to get into things that they've never re-released. You know, some of these games, N64 games don't get remade very much or re-released on other platforms. So some of these games really haven't been available since the late 90s. And I really would love for a lot of these to become available. I was hoping that would happen back on Wii, and it never really quite materialized in most cases. Maybe this is a second chance for them to make good on that. And as for the DS stuff, there are plenty of DS games I'd be more than happy to play even on the Wii U. Mario Kart DS is not one of those, but I believe they showed Yoshi Touch and Go in one of the videos. That's a game I never played, other than like an E3 demo. And I would drop a few bucks on that to kind of, you know, get to experience that. So I can think of quite a few. And then as well, if you think about the whole account system that we think is coming with DNA by the end of the year, that opens up the possibility that maybe they can start to do some of this cross-buy stuff with Virtual Console. So, if DS games do eventually come to their handhelds, we may be able to kind of retroactively get those too. So. Mm. I think, you know, the way that they're handling Wii to Wii U conversions, it might give you a sense of, well, you know, maybe you have to pay a couple bucks, but that right. might be worth it to have it on both systems. So that's better than paying full price for it all over again.
Yeah, which is the case now.
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
I really wish we could get some games that are less, you know, I don't know what this way is called. Games that are just weirder. Like if you're going to do this, Mario 64, yeah, great. Mario 64 is a great game. But maybe save that one and do something a little
Tonic
bit...
Tonic Trouble.
Sure.
Well, Namco has been pretty good on the Virtual Console so far. So I'm sure we'll see pack picks and stuff like that. That's pretty exciting.
James, I have to tell you, Ridge Racer 64 is a Nintendo game.
Wouldn't they have to clear it with Namco as a license holder?
Probably, but that game was developed and published by Nintendo.
Yeah, I know.
So anyway, let's move on from Virtual Console because that's mostly a big question
mark
right now. No, it's not sadness. I'm thrilled about it. I'm skeptical that they're really going to carry through on the promise that it holds. But I'm still excited that it's happening.
DS Virtual Console on Wii U is still dumb.
I know, and you're not wrong. You're not wrong.
I know I'm not wrong. I'm never wrong. What are you talking about?
It is a way to play games that might otherwise not be available.
It is a way to play massively upscaled games on a system that is not particularly well suited for it. Yes.
But if they release Radiant Historia for Wii U, you would be able to recommend that people play that if that's the only way they can find it.
I would be super mad at them, but yes.
If they released Radiant Historia on the Wii U Virtual Console.
If they released it on rocks, I would recommend someone go find a way to bang them together and play it. But it doesn't mean it's the best way to do it.
But
or even acceptable.
I don't think they're going to get there because they come out of the gate on this new system on the Virtual Console with Yoshi's Island DS. Really?
God!
Yeah, not really the greatest way to show off playing off the gamepad and the TV because you've got the playing field that's connected between the two on the DS, and you try to emulate that on a gamepad and TV, and it just doesn't work, you know?
What we'll be able to do is that sideways view where it just stretches it across the whole gamepad. I mean, that's
going to be the way to play it.
How the fuck do you control the game?
I don't know.
A good point.
Yeah, what makes me laugh so hard about this whole... Well, it's like a Lynx. You know, whatever way you turn it, the buttons are wherever you turn them to.
Oh, you use the stand, you put the gamepad sideways, and you use a classic controller.
Yeah, you take a stand and put your stuff on there, too. I mean, you're good to go.
Ah, okay. So can we talk about the Mario Kart 8 ROM hack that lets you go to 200cc?
That's right, yeah.
That looks pretty damn cool. I thought, okay, so they hacked the game and now it's faster, but no, like from the footage they showed, it actually affects the physics. It affects just where you can go on the tracks and what shortcuts you can take, and that's pretty exciting.
You can launch up higher off of ramps because you have more momentum.
Yep. Yep. It's just sort of, they just sort of pushed... I guess the physics engine probably just works. They said, just crank the speed.
I would like to see just how broken this is in four-player split screen. Because I know what 150cc looks like in four-player split screen, and I consider it unplayable. And I think the 200cc would be a glorious debacle.
They must have done a patch. They have to be fixed.
Well, I mean, this whole thing is a patch.
Since then, and it's just fine.
It's not, because we played it during E3 and it was bad, and we're like, "Wow,
it really is.
This is grody."
That's an interesting point. You know, I was thinking like they're really going to have to like upgrade the engine. I feel like to do this 200cc, but maybe in doing so, the lower speeds will be smoother and run better than before. They didn't say that, but
right,
it seems in the realm of possibility given the kind of.
I do like that they showed off the F-Zero DLC where it's like, hey guys, this is what F-Zero game is. It's just fast Mario Kart with F-Zero DLC. That's your F-Zero game. Enjoy it.
Well, no, that was actually, I was glad to see that because that's probably the fastest track in the game. So you see that at 200cc and it really gives you a sense of just how fast this new mode is. And
yeah.
I love that they're sending this out as a free update. I mean, they probably could have charged for this and gotten some people to pay for it. But instead, they're shooting this out to everybody. And I think... really very smartly kind of using it as a way to get people to go look at the new DLC pack, which is the Animal Crossing themed, not entirely Animal Crossing, but it includes some characters and a cup that is named after Animal Crossing. There's also the Bell Cup, which is the bell that turns you into Cat Mario. And that one, I don't think we really know anything about the tracks in there. And I'm very curious to see where they take that. In the new pack, but that's all coming out only in what, about 3 weeks? That DLC pack is coming in.
Yeah,
it's actually
the end of
coming
April.
Out early, which is fantastic.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, doing the 200cc at least gets you to put the game back in your Wii U.
Right. And then maybe you'll
buy something.
Yep. So
well, everyone has to download the content anyway, right? So might as well give them something even though they're not paying for the DLC.
That's another good way to look at it.
Well, most of the people have the DLC already because they bought the season pass for it.
Well,
who knows?
We don't
know the percentages on that. Mm. I mean,
right?
I didn't
play the game enough to justify it.
There you go. Maybe you will now. Mario Kart 8. It's pretty cool to see that they're still supporting that game almost 12 months after its initial release.
I think that also bodes well for Smash, which.
Yeah,
is an even more evergreen title in theory. So, I mean, they could still be pumping out Smash DLC a year from now.
Yeah. And this is a really, really good virtuous cycle when Nintendo releases DLC that their fans actually care about and want to buy. And they charge prices for it that don't piss us off. So Nintendo continues to make money off of these games and they continue to keep their fans happy. That's the ideal of DLC.
Well, and it gives them the opportunity to say, well, look, we still have content coming out for our system, even if it's not a full game.
Mm-hmm. I mean, think about this. I mean, probably a third of this Nintendo Direct was spent on games that came out in 2014. That's pretty amazing, you know? All right. Well, we didn't get into the Street Pass stuff, but I don't think any of us have really had
a chance for birthdays.
Yeah, the VIP thing is a whole different... can of worms.
That seems lame, but I am excited for ProPay's Fishing Resort 2.
For the Street Pass edition. Fuck it, we've got a fishing game already.
Yep. Actually, I went and I ordered it online today because fuck it. I need more fishing in my life.
Well, and James Charlton, our friend from the Family Cast, was saying he really likes the zombie game, the action game for Street
Which
Pass.
Which is made by Goodfeel.
Oh, yeah. Nice. They did the they did that shoot 'em up in the last set that I really enjoyed.
Right. Right. Yeah, it looks like a fun little action game, and I like the idea, like the interests of the Miis that you Street Pass become your weapons. So if they say, "Oh, I like video games," you actually get a Wii remote to smack zombies with. I think it's brilliant.
So if, you get, if they say I like dogs, you get a dog to smack them with?
I don't know.
I hope so.
I guess we'll find out.
I hope it's just like a freeze-dried dog. Like
oh,
just preserved.
Thanks, James. Thanks for that image.
Good. Enjoy it.
It's going to be the calcified dog from Futurama.
Yeah. Let's wrap up the Nintendo Direct talk. And I do want to say, obviously, we skipped over some of the topics because there were so many. It was like even at you know, 50 minutes or so, the Nintendo Direct, to me, felt like they were kind of racing through a lot of the announcements because they just had so much to cram in there. The funny thing is, very few actual like new game announcements that we'd never heard of before. I mean, I guess you could count Fatal Frame and maybe SMT Crossfire Emblem, but it was almost all updates to things, you know, that we have heard about before. They're just adding more detail. They're talking about you know, new features and new amiibos and stuff like that. But it was interesting. I don't think they spoiled their E3, even though there was so much to it.
Some of the games they talked about are pre-E3 anyway.
Yes, a few. Yeah, Splatoon, of course, and a few others. One other thing I want to note, they certainly did not answer the question of what's going to replace Zelda as the holiday title this year.
Not unless they're going to fast-track the hell out of SMTX Fire Emblem.
Yeah, no, I think that is still the E3 question.
Yeah.
No update on Xenoblade.
Or Star Fox.
Or Star Fox, yeah, for that matter. So they've definitely still got some cards to play for E3.
Well, Xenoblade comes out in Japan.
6 weeks away.
Comes out in Japan.
Two and a half months from now.
Xenoblade
comes out Japan next month, so there's probably not much mystery left there.
Right. I don't think Xenoblade is the big holiday title.
No, I will say one thing.
That's a very steep curve for them to get over to push that to like a mainstream Christmas audience.
And I will say, as rushed as it felt, I went back and watched the Japanese one. That one felt rushed as hell because there's a bunch of stuff in there that we're not next up on that they showed.
Yeah, they did some Rhythm Heaven, right?
They did Rhythm Heaven, they did Ace Attorney, they did a couple other RPGs that maybe we know we're going to get, but they haven't really touched on them yet for 3DS. Hmm. It was a more 3DS-heavy presentation, as you'd expect.
Yeah. All right, well, anyway, let's move on. Oh, I did want to note, though, if there's anything that we didn't talk about that you'd like us to, or if you'd like us to spend more time on any of the announcements that we just covered, please shoot us an email and we'll do that next week. So again, the address is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com and we would be happy to go back and circle around and talk about anything that we didn't have enough time for on this episode. But for now, let's move on to a fairly quick round of new business. And I want to start with Donald because, Donald, I know you're reviewing something that's related to what we just talked about.
Yeah, and it also follows on from what Guillaume talked about at the end of new business last week. I'm
Wappy Dog.
No. For review, I'm playing Devil Survivor 2 Record Breaker for the 3DS. Keep in mind this.
So about like 20% of the listeners are just like, yay, and the rest are like,
next chapter.
Yep.
Yeah. Because this comes out, I believe the embargo for the review is a month from Saturday of recording.
The embargo for
right,
the
it comes out early in May.
Yeah.
Is a month from now?
Yes. They sent me the code on March 20th, like two Fridays ago.
Jeez.
Oh my god. You know what that tells you? It tells you this game is hard as shit.
Yeah, I was gonna say, like this would scare me as a reviewer to get a code that early.
And this
hey,
is the first
don't talk about this for 6 weeks.
Yeah, and this is the first game I'm reviewing for Nintendo World Report, so
have fun with
that. But
well, I think it's better than the opposite. You're getting like a 40-hour game, and you're getting it like 2 days before the embargo. Like that's not a position you want to be in.
That is definitely the worst. So, Donald, is this like Overclocked of the first Devil Survivor? Is this a remake of a DS game?
It is. It's a remake of a 2012 DS game. So,
yeah. Good lord. Right.
One.
It came out roughly the same time as the remake of the first DS game.
Yeah. And so the big difference between the first Overclocked and the one that I'm playing is they've added in basically a extremely sped up version of the social links from the Persona series. Like you do have to, there are, instead of the interstitial cutscenes just being there to be there when you're going through through each day of the 7 day week that you're in, the conversations will actually affect your standing with the characters. And I haven't seen this yet because I'm only about in day two at this point, but you will see, you'll get rank ups, which will give them new skills. And apparently it does lead to characters potentially dying if they're not at a certain point.
Right. Well, there is some of that in the first Devil Survivor because there are branching paths. There are people you can save and you can fail to save. And there's even a whole achievement system where if you do certain things during your playthrough, then you unlock, you get points that allow you to unlock some features on your second playthrough.
Yeah. The other big thing that they've added, which I haven't gotten into yet because I kind of want to beat the main Devil Survivor 2 game first, they've added basically the equivalent of Persona 3's The Answer. In that there's a whole separate quest that you can either jump into right from the start if you've played the original, which like, 20 people have, or you can jump into it after you've beaten the game. And that's the main thing that I can't really talk about, which is good because I haven't played it. But there is a whole second quest to do. So this 40-hour game is about to become a 70-hour game.
Good. Perfect.
Right.
Why are you here? Why aren't you playing this? Get back to work.
Well, like I said, I got.
You've only got 40 days before the embargo is up. Get back to work.
Yeah,
but can you say if you're enjoying it so far? Or
I'm enjoying it. I'm about as far in this as I've ever gotten in the first Overclocked. So I am enjoying it. The battles are easy. Thankfully, I'm living on Easy Street for this one because, well, if I tried to play a full difficulty Mega 10 game, I'd probably want to, you know, smack myself in the head after a while. But this same strategy RPG, you know, goodness, you have one, basically every battle or skirmish is one round with the option to get extra turns if you choose. The only thing that's really driving me nuts is something I thought they would have gotten over after Overclocked, in that it doesn't use the top screen of the DS or the 3DS at all.
Yeah, forget about playing this on the new 3DS. You don't need even top screen. Just rip it right off.
Yeah. But, man.
So just come with the 2DS. This game is bundled with the 2DS.
Hmm. Yeah, but
for all those kids who can't look at 3D screens but can play Shin Megami Tensei Devil Survivor 2.
Well, and at least the memory card on the 2DS would fit this, because I was really afraid, based on the Japanese version, that it wouldn't fit on a standard 3DS memory card. Thankfully, I've got a 64 gig in mine, and I've got a 128 coming soon for Xenoblade, because that's almost full.
Wow. So, you have played a little bit of the first Devil Survivor. So is this like a continuation of the story of the first, the characters from the first game, or is this completely different?
Completely different story conceit. Instead of using, you know, DSs or 3DSs as the communication device, they've put it all on cell phones, which is pretty much accurate for Japan.
Fitting.
Mm-hmm.
Aside from some of the same demons that I remember using in Overclocked, there's no real similarities from the first game. I don't recall if anybody carries over.
Cool. I'm actually, like, last week I said, well, there's no way I'm getting Devil Survivor 2, because this is already, I'm playing this and it's super long, but I'm enjoying the first one enough that I'm kind of considering it.
Yeah, just
at the very least, like, I'm not gonna spit on it if there's an Atlas sale in the near future where it's $15.
Yeah, because for Guillaume, this game is launching at $60 in Canada. Oof. That's the main reason I asked to review it, because as much as I like the Atlas games, I'm sorry, the last game I paid $60 for was Mario Galaxy 2,
right?
Because Canada.
Yeah.
You got to get your dollars straight.
And 50, yeah. And it's 50 in the US, but yeah, 16 in Canada. It's just, it's hard. You might not hear about a lot of new games from me in the near future on this podcast.
I mean, even in the US, $50 for a 3DS game is very steep. Mm. That's the Atlas tax, or what we used to call the Square tax.
That's Atlas only territory.
Yeah. It's a good thing that their games are on sale perpetually on the eShop.
Well, I think it has a lot to do with the fact that they usually use high-capacity cartridges, and they're not Nintendo. So I think it costs them a lot to release these games. Personally, I would have cut, you know, all the crap that they don't need, like the voice acting. It's not very good in the first place. I turned it off.
Yeah,
so.
But it's one of those things where if it's not there, it makes the game feel low rent, even when it's not. In fact, Atlas sent out a poll on Twitter today, like, hey, would you pay extra for dual language option on voice acting? I'm like, fuck no! I don't need this. But, I mean, it's something that they're aware of. I think from their standpoint...
How about if you're going to do voice acting, do it well?
Well, yeah, obviously.
If you're going to do anything, do it well.
As far as voice acting...
We do this podcast. What are you talking about?
Well, as far as voice acting goes, Atlas is pretty much in the top tier. It could be worse. We could be talking about Arkwright's Fantasia.
Well, I mean, Atlas has a cast they reuse over and over again, essentially.
Yeah, they're decent. I mean, they're okay, but they're nothing I need to listen to. And in fact, I don't. I turn them off. The game gives you that option.
All right, well, Guillaume, I know for your new business, you've got something that's actually a pretty big change of pace from Shin Megami Tensei, which we've talked about an awful lot this episode.
Yeah, so a couple of weeks ago, Sony had this weekend fire sale, and they released a whole lot of games for less than $1. And one of those was Cloudberry Kingdom. So no, I did not play this on the Wii U, but essentially it's the same game as far as I know. Mm-hmm. And so you've talked about this game, Johnny, in the past, and I had decided to pass on it just because it's... You know, it's this kind of randomly generated platformer. Like, it generates these levels. Like, no one designed them. They just made some algorithm that creates levels that are...
Something designed them.
Right. So, like, they're fair, but they're intimidating. And, they completely change from one playthrough to the next. So, what surprises me the most about the game is that it actually works. Like, yeah. You look at the game's difficulty ramps up progressively, but it does ramp up. Initially, the levels are not that intimidating, but eventually you got spikes coming out of the floor, intermittently, and you've got these rotating, chainsaws, and you've got like all sorts of hazards just, going around. Covering the stage, you've got lasers coming from the sky, and you're supposed to dodge all that, and you think, well, there's no way this level is impossible. But eventually you make your way, you know, little by little through the stages, and you realize, no, there is a path. And usually, by not hesitating too much, by not trying to find a safe spot, and just mm-hmm. by going forward continually, eventually you find that path and you make it through the level, and it's pretty satisfying.
Yeah,
so,
that is the magic of Cloudberry Kingdom, is that it teaches you that you can beat levels that seem impossible at first.
Right.
And usually just by being bold and being courageous and just plowing through it, you find out, oh, you know what? That looked completely undoable, but actually I had everything that I needed to get through it. I just had to try.
Right. So there are several modes. There's a story mode, which is not the most interesting one in the game. And you've got some sort of arcane mode, which is more fun. You've got a about, like, what, 15 lives, and you're trying to get as far as you can. And as you play, you rank up and you unlock costumes, you unlock different modes. And no, it's pretty cool stuff. I played for a couple of hours last night. I played co-op with Karen, and she got into it more than I thought she would. And we laughed a lot. Like, the game is so ridiculous. It's so ridiculous. You've got spikes coming out of everywhere, lava, falling platforms, chainsaws, and it's just, what the hell are you supposed to do with that? And every time you die, because in many modes, you don't have lives at all, so you can just keep trying again and again, and it just becomes funny, you know, just always failing at the same spot, or like making it past that and dying immediately afterwards. It's a ton of fun. So I think it works well as some sort of party game.
Yes.
But I don't think I would play this by myself. It's not the reason why I sit down by myself and play platformers. It's not what I'm looking for in a game.
Right. Yeah. I think as a solo experience, it's engaging for a while. And at some point you just kind of, you feel like, okay, I got as far as I can get. Like, this is sort of the limit of my skills. Mm-hmm. And I probably won't ever get much farther than this. And then you're kind of done with it. But it really does work so much better as a multiplayer experience than you would expect. And that was something that I found every time I tried it, like at E3. I played some four-player at E3 one time. And I thought, this is more fun than Rayman four-players. This is more fun than Mario four-players. It's more fun than – I can't really think of any – like fast-paced, really difficult action game that you can play four players that I think is actually this much fun. There's an amazing multiplayer. There's a lot of settings. There's a lot of features you can turn on and off, and, you know, give everybody power-ups or make everybody like shrink and then get smaller like throughout the level. A lot of crazy stuff. There's my favorite is the tether. Did you try that one?
Not yet, no. But I was going to say, like, there's almost a WarioWare element to it, because you never know, like, in some modes, from level to level, you get these power-ups, and you never know what's going to be next. And so, like, oh, okay, now the characters have wings on them, so they can double jump. Oh, okay, now it's just plain characters. We, you know, jump once, it's, you know, and that's it. And then tethers or jetpacks or mini characters or giant ones, and it keeps switching up. So it's not just the levels that keep changing, but also your characters and their abilities.
And so the levels the game generates levels for you based on the abilities that you have in that level.
Right.
So the actual layout of the levels and the kinds of challenges that you have to deal with are just as unpredictable. But it always makes sure that it's going to be difficult but possible no matter what combination of crazy powers that you might have in a given level. But the tether is one that you and Karen should really try, because it connects your two characters together, and you can kind of pull on each other once you get to the end of that tether, which can make for some hijinks. But the funniest part is if someone gets impaled by spikes or fire or something, the other character has to drag their dead carcass around.
Oh.
So it like weighs you, it weighs you down and makes it harder for the other person. So you really want to encourage each other to both stay alive, because you really depend on each other to get through the level. Although in a lot of cases it is possible to kind of stumble across the finish line dragging someone's dead body behind you. Wandering Kingdom is I've tried to like sell as many people as I can on it, because I think it's such a wonderful, like surprisingly delightful experience, and I
really think in party I think in party settings it's probably optimal, and I think, you know, I paid less than $1 for this, but $10 would have been fair. Or sometimes it's on sale in the eShop for $5 or whatever. That's also a fair price. I say people should go for it.
I jumped onto that one of those $5 sales. I didn't really get into it, but I think I may give it see if I can give it a shot now that I have consistent local co-op as well.
No, it's fun. Yeah. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, the main knock I have is that the presentation isn't all that great. But when you consider the way the levels are made, maybe that's okay, you know, just because it has to be able to piece together all these different elements and all their hitboxes and things like that, and in a very tight way. So I don't know that excuses the artwork and the music or whatever, but it kind of doesn't matter that much. That's not really why you play this particular game.
Yeah.
All right, well, James, what do you have for new business? Another mystery this week.
Yeah, I kind of like it this way, but...
I can tell.
You know, after John went... I mean, John really took over last week and was babysitting Mama. I really...
He did.
Like, the dog is, you know, taking care of a dog is hard work. Taking care of babies is much, much harder work. So, especially when you have to perform surgery just to interact with it. So I had to give him that one. But I decided to one-up him by taking care of many babies. And I downloaded Conception 2.
Oh.
Because
I was waiting for that.
Because I baited John thinking I had it 2 weeks ago. And then said, well, now I should actually go ahead and do it. And I'm not going to talk a whole lot about it, even though it's a pretty lengthy game. And I've pumped some time into it.
Don't say pump.
Yeah,
I'll say whatever please. I want. Thank you. So I do think that there's two thoughts I have on this game. One is that if none of the stuff that this game is infamous for was there, which is this veneer of just general skeeviness, it would be a decently effective, although ultimately fairly forgettable RPG on the 3DS. That is to say that how the dungeons play out is okay. It's just there's a lot of them, and they're, you know, they take a while to get through, but, you know, the battle system's pretty good. The fact that you have this party of what essentially are children that you create of different classes that you can mix them to get different skill sets. Like, there's a lot of stuff here that actually works really well as a game. But there is also this sort of weird veneer of interacting with these incredibly two-dimensional, except when they're not, female characters in an attempt to raise your relationship with them. That's just not well executed. Even if you remove the weird pseudo-sexual stuff. Like, just the characters themselves aren't particularly well, you know, written out. Some of the writing is odd. Like, as if, like, they'll reference things that aren't there, as if, like, they cut some stuff when they localize it. It's weird. So I'm basically just grinding through that stuff and getting back into the dungeon, because the reward there is ultimately you get access to stronger types of these children that you produce with them. It's... oof. But a lot of the time I'm playing the game and going through that crap, it's me going, really, game? But I'm not angry at it or upset with it. It's just the game doing what it do. And a lot of times, it's just kind of funny. Like, not the way they intend. It's just like, oh, of course. Yeah, that's how that had to go. Yeah, absolutely. But it is more self-aware than I think when I talked about it from the demo, I gave it credit for. Like, there are times where the writing... like, everybody is super prudish in every other scenario except for, like, that one skeevy moment of interactivity where these children are created. Otherwise, the game is, like, everybody's, like, they get, like, super nervous if characters brush up against each other. It's such a disconnect that it's kind of like, okay, game, you get it together. But every so often, the game will have a character say something incredibly just not appropriate, and I just get really amused by it. It's the point where there's no way. So I'll give a good example. There is Street Pass functionality in this game. You will never, ever, 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 ever encounter someone who has a copy of this game. It's a Street Pass.
Well, even if they have a copy, they're not going to enable Street Pass because they would be admitting that they have this game.
The shit out of my Street Pass for this game. Because the whole premise of the game is, as you get to know these girls, you do something called class mating, which is a terrible pun, that creates these children. Ultimately, all it is they hold hands. And then a child is born from really poorly described things. But in the animation for that, it's this really unnecessary silhouetted characters doing things while music is playing that's just really not appropriate.
Like saxophone or?
Like lyrics. Like it's just, it's basically just like, I want to love you, weird stuff like that. Like,
What are the silhouetted characters? Are we talking like Mass Effect, like humping scenes here?
No. It's literally just
dancing
them
around.
Like, so you only ever see the girl. It's literally just like her like stretching and then like reaching out her hand or something like that. It's not necessary, but it's also not just pornography either.
Okay.
But In the Street Pass mode, the idea is that they've created this system where two males are able, because you can only Street Pass with your other male character, and they refer to it as class manting, because they're aware of what they're doing, and they just don't fucking care.
Class manting?
Yes, as versus class mating, because the characters are male this time. It's like, it's, there's lots of weird things like that where I kind of laugh at the game. I'm like, okay, you got me. Nice work. Good job, game. But, you know, it is a decently mindless RPG with the exception of the stuff that's weird and unnecessary. It is a strange experience that I'm glad I had, I think. But
yeah, do you think this is worth having your name put in a file somewhere?
Yeah, it's already in a file. What are you talking about? Yeah.
This really feels, honestly, Conception 2 feels like something that is probably more appropriate for the Vita.
It's on the Vita.
On
the Vita as well.
I own it. And
there you go.
And
the main reason
I bought it was actually call back to the last time I was on. There's free DLC for both versions that lets you kill the bear from Danganronpa.
Nice.
Mm.
It is weird. This is a weird game, and it does occasionally stuff that is, you're just like, that's not really, I'm not comfortable with this. But it also does stuff where I'm just amused by the fact that it just doesn't give a shit. And it's just like, this game is what I am, and you're going to have to deal with it. And I just go, okay, just do what you need to do. I'll go get my fully evolved battle child and take it into the arena to fight with.
A fully evolved battle child.
That's my naming for it. I think they refer to them as star children. But basically, you have to cash them in every so often because they max level out, and then you get better star children. It's just...
Do you feed them to each other?
No.
Or you just mate them? You mant them with each other?
I swear to God, the idea of the game is you are raising them. So after you produce them with the mother, and sometimes you have twins, and you have to be prepared for that, is they level up in the dungeons, and then because they've fully grown up, you, quote, grant them their independence, and they go out in the world and find a job.
Sow your oats.
There you go. I'm now officially a better father than John Lindemann because I've had 72 children. So John, I know you're not here right now, but you're on notice. Get on it.
Hey, phrasing.
Get to pumping.
That's right, because he's only had a baby. I've had 72 fully grown adult children.
Wow.
Yep.
I'm speechless.
Father Abraham over here. All right,
there we go.
I will wrap up new business, and I guess very briefly I can mention that I did download Box Boy today. I've had very little time to play it, mainly got it on the strength of the reviews because we heard excellent things about it from the Fami crew, and then Neil Ronahan gave it a very, very strong review and seemed to find it delightful, and then I saw it on the Nintendo Direct and thought, man, that looks cool.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very straightforward puzzle platformer, but the way that your character moves, the way you make these boxes extend from, I mean, you are a box, you're a box boy, but you make these almost like copies of yourself that extend out from you. Almost, they look like Tetris blocks basically, and you can either throw those onto switches or make stepping stones out of them, or even use them to extend yourself up to higher platforms and then basically sort of drag yourself up with them. It's a little bit hard to describe, but when you see it, it makes total sense. And
right.
And one thing I like about the game is that it seems very much just about get to the end. You know, it's like very straightforward. It is definitely an action game. It's a platforming game. There's a little bit of puzzleness in, you know, figuring out how you're going to get over each ledge. But I think the bigger challenge just comes from doing that without falling into a pit. And then I found that some of the crowns that you're trying to collect along the way are timed. So in some cases, you kind of want to do this stuff quickly. At first, I thought, oh, this is interesting. It's a platformer with no timer. But then I got a few stages in and I found out that there are certain crowns that you have to be fast to get, which... okay, we'll find out if that annoys me or not. I am increasingly finding that I like games that don't have timers, but we'll see. But I like the really clean look of it, even though it doesn't appear to be in 3D at all on the top screen, which is kind of too bad. But I do like the art style quite a bit. It's very, very clean.
It's very minimalist.
Yeah. Yeah, but the animation looks good, which is key. It kind of runs very smoothly, and I like that to it. So I'll probably have more to talk about that next week, but I'm enjoying it so far. And I wanted to spend a couple of minutes talking about a game that is unfortunately is not on Nintendo platforms, though it has kind of a connection, and that would be Valiant Hearts The Great War, which is a Ubisoft game from last year that I recently got as part of PlayStation Plus. And I'd actually been thinking about buying this over the holidays and then ended up not really having time to, because as you guys know, I was moving cross country over the holidays and was really busy with other things. So in, I think it was February or March, this became one of the PlayStation Plus games, and I thought, oh, perfect, because I'd been meaning to buy that anyway. And I've recently been playing it, and I really like it a whole lot. The other thing that made me even more curious about it was seeing that it was nominated for a whole bunch of awards at DICE back in February, and seeing the footage on the on the clip reels at the DICE Awards, I don't know that I'd really seen it in motion very much before then, and I was really struck by just how beautiful the hand-drawn artwork is and how evocative it is in the World War I setting, because it uses the same engine as Child of Light, which was the other Ubisoft game released last year on download platforms, and that one did come out on Wii U. And I played Child of Light, and I spent a whole lot of time with it, way more than I should have, quite frankly. And in the end found that I kind of liked the first half of it a lot more than the second half. Not that they're that much different. It just kind of goes on for way too long, and it doesn't ever really do anything new after about halfway through the game. And the writing in that game really grated on me after a while. I mean, it's not good from the beginning, but as you go on, there's just more and more of it, and it's really bad.
It's like sand in your eye. It just keeps going.
Exactly. And then by the ending, it's really the whole rhyming thing, but even just the way the story is told doesn't make a whole lot of sense. The characters aren't consistent with each other. It's really just a big old mess. And ultimately, it's an RPG with a pretty fun battle system, but a lot of other things about it I didn't care for. But mainly what you can say is it's pretty, but you know what? Valiant Hearts is prettier, I think. I think Valiant Hearts looks better, I think it sounds better, and it is about 1,000 times better written than Child of Light. So it's, maybe not a complete fair comparison. I mean, this is really more of a kind of like an old school PC adventure game. It actually, if you've played The Cave, which is also available on Wii U, Valiant Hearts plays a lot like The Cave, including with a lot of voiceover narration as you run around and do things. You can only hold one item at a time, so you're solving these little kind of mini puzzles. You never have to go very far with anything that you find. And there aren't that many actions available to you, but a lot of them do basically come down to walking over and clicking on something. Or when you have the little dog with you, you can send the dog off to go click on things for you, which basically means he can pull switches or he can go and grab something that you can't get to and then bring it back to you. And it's pretty clever about how it uses those things. But the puzzles are, for the most part, really simple, not that difficult. They're engaging and they kind of give you a way to interact with the environment. But the main thrust of the game is really just in the story. A lot of it is just walking through these hellscapes of people dying all over the place. These cartoon soldiers, from World War I, they're just dying all over the place. Machine gun fire raining in from overhead, artillery shells all over the place. Flamethrowers and zeppelins dropping bombs, and I mean just really awful stuff. I mean, trench warfare, literally trench warfare, yeah. Being portrayed in a 2D hand-drawn cartoony video game, and none of that seems like it should work, and it totally works. It works so well, and I'm really kind of blown away by it. I adore this game. I've never really played anything quite like it, especially in how it juggles the tone, because there's some comedy in here, but there's a lot of sadness. It's a very melancholic game, and I think that offsets the beautiful piano music and the really nice writing. It offsets it's one of those things like maybe you could compare it to Grave of the Fireflies. In the sense that it's a very, very sad emotional story that's made like you can, it's something that if it was done with live action or if it was done in a very realistic way, it would be basically unwatchable because it's so sad. But because it's animated, it kind of lets them push things a little farther than they'd be able to if it wasn't animated. And I feel like Valiant Hearts kind of goes there. It's incredibly effective. And you know, one thing I was recommending this to James last week after the show. And one of the things that I appreciate so much about it is that it is jam-packed with information, just facts and trivia and context. And it really, it tries to give you a sense of what this war was like. And it was released on the 100-year anniversary of the start of World War I in 1914. And it really is very aware of the fact that most people in this day and age really don't know very much about World War I, and we probably should know more. And it delivers a lot of, like, actually educational material in a very, very palatable way. It's almost all optional. You don't have to read it if you don't want to. But what I find is that it's written so well, and it builds up the world of the game and the story of the game in such a great way that I'm always eager to read that stuff as soon as it's available. And I'm out looking for every little hidden item all over the maps because I want to read about, you know, this rag that was soaked in urine in order to save someone from chlorine gas because they didn't have gas masks. That stuff is, I mean, dreadful. Like, so much of the story and the writing in this game is really tragic and sad and awful. And they talk about these amazing numbers being thrown around about hundreds of thousands of people dying in the space of a month. And it's just, it's kind of unfathomable. And yet it's portrayed in the game in such a way that it makes it feel like you can actually kind of connect to it. And I love that. And the other thing I learned about the war is that most of the people involved in the war also didn't really know what it was about and didn't really understand why the hell it was happening in the first place, which is a feeling that I feel like as a civilization, we've not really moved on from. I think most of us still don't really understand what it was all about because it was kind of a war like built up on a bunch of nothing.
Yeah, it was a war that everybody thought, well, this will blow over in a couple of days.
Yeah, and then it just got worse and worse, and it just kept going. And it's like having a fight with your parents where by the end of it you can't remember why you were what you were fighting over in the first place. I mean, except that happened on a humongous, horrible, hellacious scale. So anyway, it's one of those stories that I think video games are maybe uniquely equipped to tell a story about this and to educate someone who might otherwise never, I mean, I would never read a book about World War I. That sounds like a dreadful experience, but playing this video game about World War I has been, I'll say, delightful. It has been informative and heartbreaking and incredibly compelling. And every time I play it, I just want to keep playing it. And I really hate putting it down. And I've learned so much about it. And I've connected with these historical events in a way that I didn't know if I ever would. And I would love for them to do this with other things too. And you know, I've talked before on this show about how I have a lot of issues with the way war is portrayed in video games. And I think it's, in many, many, many cases, maybe almost always, I think video games really kind of do a disservice to war. They actually kind of strip away a lot of the things that are the most interesting about war. They have nothing productive to say about war, certainly, and probably in a lot of cases counterproductive. And I think they actually don't even take advantage of the setting of wars in a way that actually helps the game be a better game in the ways that they could. Valiant Hearts actually seizes upon some of the potential there that I've talked about in the past. And I'm kind of shocked that it would happen in the particular kind of game that it is, but I'm very happy.
And also in the Ubisoft game. So, of course.
What's the nationality of the company that made this game?
It was Montpellier.
Okay.
French.
Yeah. So, and this is a little bit of a disconnect if you live in North America. If you don't live in North America, you live in Europe, especially listening to this show, you might find that our lack of knowledge of the First World War is kind of jarring.
Sure. But the U.S. wasn't as deeply involved with World War I as it was with II, for instance.
Well, and keep in mind, and this is something you guys might not realize, is that most of the countries in Europe, with the exception of Germany and Russia, because they got the shit kicked out of them in World War II, had significantly higher numbers of deaths in the First War than the Second. So, like, France lost, like, 4.25% of its population. Like, if you think about that, 4 out of 100 people died in that war. That's an insane number. Yeah. So, in like, France, the UK, the war is much, much, much more – there's much higher degree of awareness of just the sheer brutality of that conflict. Whereas in the U.S., we had fairly limited casualties, but in World War II, we had incredibly, you know, high numbers of losses. It's a very – different culture here. So if we sound like fucking Americans don't know anything about history, well, let me explain. There's a reason. But
yeah, yeah.
I mean, to give context to what you're experiencing, Johnny, like this is these are battles where thousands of people died in a day, and for literally no tangible gain whatsoever on either side. Like nothing changed. They just died.
Yeah, yeah, and arguably for no reason at all. I mean,
yeah,
you know,
nothing was accomplished, and there was no reason for the fight anyway. Yes.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of an ensemble cast of characters in Valiant Hearts. One of them is American, and it actually gives some context. He's in the Foreign Legion of the French Army. He volunteered to help the French fight the Germans, even though he was American. But the other characters are all European. And there's also, I'll say this for Guillaume and Donald, there's a fair bit of information I found really, really interesting about Canada's involvement. And the troops of Canadian soldiers who were involved in various conflicts. So I think no matter where you're from, there's a lot to be learned from Valiant Hearts. And it's also a completely entertaining and fascinating and wonderful and lovely video game as well. It's not just, you know, edutainment.
Yeah.
in the pejorative sense. So it's wonderful. I don't know why the hell this isn't on Wii U. I mean, Child of Light is on there. Maybe it just didn't sell, and they just decided to not bother with that.
Maybe they decided that this grim, dark expression of a really, really horrible moment in human history doesn't really match the Wii U demographics.
Yeah, I think that's unfortunate. I think that's a mistake, I think you should play this game if you can find a way to do so. I'm sure it's on PC as well, so and I don't think it would take a very strong PC to run it. So anyway, that's Valiant Hearts. James, I think especially you should play it, but I think almost anybody would probably find something to appreciate about it. All right, well, that's kind of a serious note to end this segment on, but we do need to end it because there's lots of listener mail to come up after the break. We're going to be talking about Zelda and Amiibo and other dumb things, so please stick around.
Now playing, a sampling of the best new original content at NintendoWorldReport.com.
Hey, it's Now Playing. I already have an intro. I do this every week. It's not necessary. Hi, John.
Hi, John. This is the real John Lindemann.
Technically accurate. So, yeah, it's time for Now Playing. I don't know. We do this every week. I don't know what we do anyway. First up this week,
We're promoting.
It's true, we are promoting. We are promoting a website. And speaking of promoting,
Spoilering the website.
Are you quite finished?
No.
Good. First up this week, we have a feature, My Joyless Amiibo Journey by Justin. Since the inception of Now Playing, we've been taking one broadside after another at the seemingly endless capacity for Justin to collect plastic items molded to resemble Nintendo characters. We've recommended he receives professional help, that he's actually a plant trying to gin up sales, that he uses less than legitimate means to fund his collections, that he... Anyway, not the point. This feature is more of an epic poem. In it, Odysseus Berube goes from trial to trial in order to find Amiibo. Unlike Odysseus, he doesn't show up at Target, and, well, he keeps his cool. Speaking of Amiibo, we have another feature! We have two this week about Amiibo, God help us. Could this be our dystopian Amiibo future? By Neil Ronahan. Late last year, we received what might be the worst Nintendo/Terminator crossover fanfic ever written, with a cautionary note that we should not post it until the futility of Amiibo, and indeed life, was manifest. Now you can go read this Huskly-esque allegory for our future.
I'm pretty sure number of amiibo features is inversely proportional to the number of actual amiibos.
It's you will find more amiibo angst on Nintendo World Report than you will find Jigglypuffs.
Zero Jigglypuffs. Next up, I have a review from Becky Holiday. It's called Story of Season. It's one of the Harvest... It's either the real Harvest Moon or it's the fake Harvest Moon. This is a real Harvest Moon.
That's why we have the script.
Harvest Moon. It's a real Harvest Moon. But it's not called Harvest Moon.
No. It's all in the script.
Yes.
That was in the script.
It's in the script.
It is the script.
Script. Yes.
John, come on, get it together, John.
I got it. Harvest Moon ended up in the hands of the Japanese publisher Marvelous, supporting new name and familiar gameplay. Becky is more than a bit of an expert on the topic of farming, crafting, courting, animal husbandry, and her skills are on full display in this review. Most will be utterly lost. But if you loved Harvest Moon games of years past, she's got lots of praise that will mean something to you. She's pretty good at the game.
She's quite good. John, you're pretty good at Harvest Moon games as well, aren't you?
The real John Lindemann plays Harvest Moon all the time.
It's true. I can speak firsthand. The real John Lindemann does play Harvest Moon all the time.
And he lives in a yurt.
Anyway.
Next up, with the Nintendo Down Report, we have Suspension Railroad Simulator. It's probably not necessary to state that Dan is the one reviewing this. I also probably don't need to mention that it's awful. I will say I am filled with hope for Dan, though. After weeks of asking him to just stop doing this to himself, his own words have given us a mission. Vertically suspended monorail is quite uncommon.
This is a quote from the review.
Vertically suspended monorail is quite uncommon. While you float above street level, you will have a fantastic view of the city beneath you. I sure hope to experience the majesty of it all someday. Listeners, it is now your job to find Dan a suspension railroad to ride. He needs to take the Hyperloop.
That's neither a suspension nor a railroad.
But it's 3D travel in a 3D space.
It also doesn't exist. This is Nintendo World Reports, now playing Radio Free Nintendo.
Presenting the real John Lindemann.
God help me. This is us giving back to Don after months of pleading. Don, we will find you a vertically suspended monorail for you to ride so you may experience the majesty at some point in your life. That is a promise I make to you in this very respectable, not in any way, shape, or form, amateurish segment that we have just recorded.
Can't we just put him on a rocket?
And for more amateurism, I mean not amateurism, you can go to our website, NintendoWorldReport.com.
Welcome back, everybody. It is time for listener mail, and oh boy, do we have some things that you want to hear about. The address, as always, is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com, and I've asked Donald to read the first email this week.
Justin writes, "Hello. Lately, I can't help but chuckle whenever the topic of Amiibo comes up, mainly due to the disdain you all have for them. I am an avid collector of them myself, but it's always nice to get a little reminder that I am way too old to be obsessing over plastic figures with minimal functionality." Which brings me to my question. So far, the actual usefulness of Amiibo in games has been lackluster at best. Though the new Toad Amiibo has reinvigorated my interest in Captain Toad, and the Fire Emblem characters are a big incentive to pick up codename Steam, I was wondering what, if any, game functionality would it take to get you interested in Amiibo?
I want to say right off that that's some kind of weird backwards place where plastic figures have encouraged him to buy a $40 game.
I don't see how the codename, like the Fire Emblem characters and codename Steam would work, though, because there aren't any of the Fire Emblem characters in the wild.
Well, yeah, right. if you had somehow managed to get a Marth amiibo, presumably because you work at Nintendo, there you go. So I this email is kind of funny timing because
yes, it is.
I actually bought a Mega Man amiibo not because I'm going to use it, but because I want to give money to somebody for Mega Man, and if Nintendo's gonna take it, well, at least somebody will fucking take my money for Mega Man. Capcom, what the fuck's wrong with you? Like, this, it's, I actually bought it because I really like the figure. I think the Mega Man, I had never seen one in the wild before. It looks really good. I have an undying love of the Mega Man franchise. And for me, this was just like an impulse buy of like, whatever. The only other amiibo I would ever, ever consider buying is Jigglypuff. because...
Well, too bad, buddy.
Because I have turned using Jigglypuff as a joke in online Smash matches into something of a personal, my personal way of being. Unfortunately, apparently Jigglypuff is enough to crash the sales servers of games of a major games retailer, so is what it is.
Yeah. Oh, boy. So there's a lot we could get into here just on the general topic of Amiibo. I mean, to directly answer the question, I don't know if there's anything Nintendo – now, could Nintendo lock certain content behind Amiibo that is so significant that I would begrudgingly go out and buy an Amiibo to unlock it? Potentially. Is there anything they could put in a game that I would think would be justified in locking behind an Amiibo? No. I think, you know, there are certain potential use cases for Amiibo where you're actually saving data to that figure and taking it out into the world for some purpose, like the Smash Brothers character figures or figure players. That doesn't interest me, but I think that is still by far the most interesting use of Amiibos, and I think there's actual merit to that idea. But in terms of Amiibos unlocking things or making characters suddenly appear in your game, I mean, you know those Fire Emblem characters aren't actually on the Fire Emblem Amiibo, right? They're already in the game. So it's back in the old days of on the 360 when people found out that all the DLC in those Capcom games was already on the disc and all you're downloading is like 100 kilobyte key that just right. unlocks the data. That's exactly what Amiibos are in 90% of the games that are supporting them right now. And I will never think that's okay. Ever. So if Amiibo functionality is about unlocking content in games, then fuck Amiibo forever. Okay. But if Nintendo can find ways of actually making Amiibos, you know, I mean, they're always going to be overpriced memory cards. But if they can find ways of making overpriced memory cards actually be an integral part of a game, then maybe they could be okay one day. I mean, for me, the thing that might actually get me to buy an Amiibo one day is that they start making them out of yarn. Because that Yoshi is fucking adorable.
Yeah.
I have much greater affinity for plush figures than I do for little figures.
What about these two card games they've announced? They've got the Fire Emblem card game, which I don't know.
Are those Amiibo cards?
They are Amiibo cards.
Okay, I didn't hear that part of it. That's interesting.
And then they've got the Animal Crossing, whatever it's called.
Happy Home.
Happy Home, yeah. As our site staffer Carly referred to it, use the force to move furniture game. Where it's the cards interact with the game, but they're also cards. I mean, they're obviously a lot cheaper.
Sure.
It would be, you know, I guess it would be somewhat advantageous as an Amiibo entry point for that versus, you know, $11 figures. But it sort of goes to the question of what's their long-term plan? Like, if this is their slow burn-up for making just Nintendo making its own toys versus licensing them, they all have some kind of stupid chip in them to do something somewhere in some game someday, then, like, sure, you know, eventually we'll all end up with Amiibos because this is what Nintendo's toy functionality is, but I mean, to make it actually something that matters to the game, but I don't feel like I'm getting ripped off by having to have an Amiibo. It would have to be an Amiibo I already own, which is going to be a problem because there's never going to be another Mega Man game ever.
I don't think it's desirable that Nintendo comes up with content that is locked behind Amiibo that we can't do without, because then I'm just going to do without the game. That's the thing. I don't think that these figures can appeal to people who have no interest in collecting or in figurines.
Right.
I just don't think there's a way. Like, they're just going to ignore the games that these figurines are essential for.
There's something inherently irrational about the whole experience. Now, the Toad one's interesting because it does add some additional objectives to Captain Toad, which...
It's also interesting in that you cannot find a Toad Amiibo.
Yeah, they are impossible to get.
There aren't that many people who bought Captain Toad, and there aren't that many people who could buy a Toad Amiibo, and the intersection of the two is, I bet, in the thousands.
I mean, I do. I this is this is
Justin is one of the few in this case who's actually enjoying that feature right now.
This whole experience is the strangest situation of supply and demand going completely nuts for a reason I can't comprehend. I mean, this is like old Pokemon cards, stupid sometimes.
Yeah, this has been a complete disaster, and I'm going to say something that's going to piss off a lot of people who buy Amiibos. But these figures should be a lot more expensive than they are.
They should be. I mean, that's the reality situation. Apparently
I ain't no economist, but if you're making a limited number of something and you can't keep them in stock, that means your price is too low.
What do you want to bet those? Have the price for the yarn ones come out yet?
No.
I bet they're expensive.
It's going to be packed in with a game, though.
That is not confirmed.
It's confirmed for Europe. They've shown confirmed for Europe. Some of the box art for it.
Well,
that would make me extremely happy. Oh, well, actually,
they'll probably just price it into the game.
Actually, I would rather buy the Amiibo by itself because I'm going to want to download the game.
There you go.
But
I mean, what? Yeah,
but
I mean,
that would at least reduce the demand for them. It might make it easier to find one that's separate from the game.
Or they'll just release a tiny, tiny number of Amiibo. It'll be like the gold Mario Amiibo that came with Mario Party, whatever.
No, the gold Mario was just sold separately.
The gold was the Walmart exclusive that you had to be a member of the Walton family to get a hold of.
I think amazingly, with Amiibo, Nintendo has actually kind of teased out every single one of the worst things about the retail experience in the year 2015.
They've really nailed it.
They've actually managed to make this the worst possible consumer environment that they possibly could for their most hardcore fans. And I think a lot of their hardcore fans, a lot of the people who are really into Amiibo are kind of obsessed with it because it's such a giant pain in the ass to actually purchase these things. I look at it all as remarkably obnoxious and like kind of, you know, like cruel,
gross.
Actually, to these fans. Ugh, but clearly it drives some people absolutely. It's like, you know, it's like the woman playing hard to get in an old, you know, screwball comedy or something. I mean, it's some people just absolutely cannot resist the idea that there's like barely any of these and that everybody else wants it just as much as you do. And you have to be the one who's the most cunning who can finally get it. But, you know, like people like Chris Kohler today was tweeting that, well, I went to the bathroom and when I came back, Jigglypuff was all gone. Yeah. You know, I mean, if Chris Kohler can't buy something like this, then there's something very wrong with the system.
There's an article on NWR, if it's not up already, it'll be up probably early next week, from the guy who does the Nintendo Collector's Journal, Justin Berube, who's given up on Amiibo. That's how bad it's going.
I don't believe that for a second.
Good for him.
If Justin Berube has given up on Amiibo, then that's saying something. I mean,
now, the Amiibo tap thing that they announced, I think is pretty cool. It's not something I'm going to buy a ton of Amiibo for, but it's pretty cool. It's this kind of demo, like virtual console demo thing where you play these short challenges. Like if they make that like some sort of NES remix or SNES remix, but, you know, with Amiibo, then, you know, that's pretty cool. Although I would much rather
for NES remix.
Me too. But I mean, at least it's something that you can do with those figurines.
I think it's great. It's great in that, you know, like young kids who really want the figures because they want the figures, you know, they've maybe not necessarily played a lot of Luigi games or whatever. I love the idea that that they might actually experience some of these old games, just because, well, I've already got the figure. I have a Wii U. I'm not necessarily using the figure to play any of my games. I just bought it because I like the toy. But maybe I should try some of this stuff since it's free. And I'm sure that Amiibo Tap thing is going to be full of links to go buy.
Oh, yeah.
Go buy the full virtual console game on the eShop for only $5.
But since it is random, no matter what Amiibo you put on, it's going to be like, come on, no whammies, stop at Urban Champion.
Wario's
you know
Woods.
What? Look, we did a whole episode about Urban Champion. It is a great classic game from Nintendo's library. You should shut your mouth. Or I will punch it in like a true urban champion
into a manhole.
To me, what it's going to take for me to buy Amiibos is it's got to be a character that I just adore. Probably ironically, in the case of Mega Man, it's just because I've been abused by Capcom for the last decade and a half or so. But like, if they went out and put like a Groose amiibo on the market, yeah, whatever. Fuck it. Here's my money. Take it. Because that's such a terrible, awesome character. It's just like, you know what? Yeah, I approve of you just being complete monsters and putting this on store shelves. But for functionality, I just don't know what it would be that I wouldn't feel like I was being taken.
Yeah, there's... Yeah. And currently, right now, there's nothing. I've got a Luigi amiibo. I bought it for Karen because she loves the character. But then I saw some much better looking Luigi figurines on the internet. Much pricier, but so much cooler looking. And I regret the purchase. You know, like there's this Nendoroid, I think, Luigi amiibo. Not amiibo. It's not an amiibo.
Figurine.
But it's a kick-ass figurine. It's so cute.
See, I do wonder, like I said, I do wonder if Nintendo just slowly starts making all of their licensed toys themselves and just sticking these chips in them. Like, it's as just an alternative revenue streams, as we talked about when we had the mobile conversation. Because it seems like it's a division that they could set up pretty easily, and they could easily just like, well, these amiibos are great, we can just use these. And it lets them continue to have an active relationship with the retail space, even as they're trying to phase into a digital sales environment for their software, even if they're actively antagonizing the retail space by decimating their sales and web infrastructure.
It is definitely interesting to see amiibo start to take on different form factors.
Yeah.
You know, there's the plush ones with Yoshi.
The cards.
For my money, the plush ones really are like dramatically more appealing.
Sure.
Visually, from a tactile standpoint, that is something I would be much more likely to buy for someone else as a gift. And something that I could see, you know, throwing it on the couch or whatever, and just it being sort of becoming part of your home, you know, a very small.
Well, I mean, they're not that big.
Thing. Yeah, exactly. That's I get it. But actually, I could see amiibo also being put into larger, stuffed characters. You know, basically teddy bear type form factors. But also, you look at the cards, and it's like, okay, at this point, it's basically the e-reader, and I don't know that there's a terrific justification for something like that. But at least then you could carry a deck of something. You could carry like a lot of them. You know, and they're more affordable and much easier to mass produce. So you're not going to have, presumably, you're not going to have the kind of supply constraints that you do with these figurines.
Sure.
When you're just printing them on cards and there's a chip in the card, but the chip is generic.
Right.
It's the chip is the easy part to put in. It's with the current amiibo, it's the plastic figure that's the hard thing to make. And that's why there aren't enough of them. So the card definitely solves that problem. Of course, also the card is not going to be as desirable, probably, as the
figures. Sure, but the barrier of entry is super low, and you can try to make it up on volume.
Yep. So it'll be interesting to see just where they go from here on it.
Capitalism,
Yep. They're making a lot of money on it, so good for them. If you like them, keep trying to buy them.
Good luck.
Guillaume, would you please read the next email?
Sure. Michael writes, "Has Inuma been a good steward of the Zelda franchise? Inuma has now directed more console Zelda games than Miyamoto, but he seems unable to improve or build upon what Miyamoto has created. Instead, Inuma is an experimenter. For each of his games, he has a hook or gimmick that he inserts into the formula in order to differentiate it. The result is a series of inventive and creative games that are all marred to some degree or other by various flaws. They need iteration to be perfected, but Inuma seems to be unable or unwilling to iterate in that way. And to bring this back to my main question, any gameplay hook significant enough to halt forward progress on the Wii U game and cause a one-year delay is bound to be extremely divisive. I believe it is now the destiny of Zelda Wii U to be yet another Zelda game that disappoints a large percentage of the Zelda fanbase." Well, that's every Zelda. But anyway, considering that this is now Inuma's consistent track record, what do you think? Is he actually a good steward of the franchise? There's not a fan base on Earth that is not divided and disappointed in anything and everything. I'm just going to throw that out.
Zelda fans, Guillaume just called you all babies.
No, I'm just saying, like, the you can't please everyone.
And the more passionate and the more entrenched a fan base is, the more critical they're going to be and the harder they are to please. And so,
yeah, you're going to have the people who love the Dungeons and the Zelda games. You've got the people who really want them to go away. You've got the people who care deeply about timelines. And you've got people who are as much Zelda fans, as big Zelda fans, who really don't care about the story. So,
yep, that's a great point. I mean, I think when you have such a demanding audience, demanding and loud and brash and unpleasable as Zelda fans are, I think I have a great respect for Mr. Onuma and his team for continuing to basically make surprising new things that we don't see coming. Because it would be so easy for him to try to please everybody and to try to listen too much. I mean, you have to listen some, but the trick is knowing how much is enough. And I'm always kind of amazed when I play a new Zelda game and see all the things they put in there that I would have never even thought to ask for. And I'm so glad that they have enough autonomy and that they believe in themselves enough to keep trying new things in order to try to find something that we don't even know that we want, because that's really what their job is. You know, if they're going to keep making games in this series, you have to keep it fresh. You have to make it exciting. You have to make it unpredictable. It's very hard to do when there's literally like 20 Zelda games now.
Yeah.
And there's a shitload of these things. And I wouldn't want to be in charge of having to make Zelda 21 and make it fresh and exciting and try to make millions of fans all over the world happy with it. It's impossible. And I think he's actually done a pretty damn good job of it, especially over such a long period of time.
I would argue, though, to one point that Michael makes here, Zelda Unnamed Wii U was never fucking coming out this year. Like, all we've ever seen of that game was somebody riding a horse through a field. I mean, that game wasn't delayed because of some crazy-ass idea he had. And that game was delayed because Nintendo gave a date to try to make their fans feel good about themselves. Like, they might have thought, maybe it's possible we might somehow hit 2015, but it's probably not going to happen. It's one of those, it's better to do it and ask for forgiveness later kind of deals.
Well, but, you know, the explanation that Onuma gave in his little YouTube mea culpa last week was that, hey, we originally thought we would finish this in 2015, but then things kind of took an unexpected turn. Basically, we were on track. And then things started developing in such a way, and we kept coming up with these new ideas, and we decided that it was better to delay the game and put these in than to leave them out.
That sounds like they may have been on pace to develop a game for 2015 that was pretty bare bones at best. Because to me, this game always – I mean, all they've shown of this game is literally what we would call two teasers.
Yeah.
I mean, this is supposedly a huge game. The standard operating procedure of showing off a Zelda tells us that's not a good sign for the game coming out the year they're showing the teasers off in.
Mm-hmm.
There are several Zelda games that were shown during several E3s in a row, right?
Right. All of them. Yeah. All of the console Zelda games since what?
Link to the Past, probably, because Ocarina.
No, because I think Majora's Mask only showed up one time. But
that's true. Yeah, Majora's Mask was only at 2000.
But Ocarina of Time was it two? Was it? I know it was at least multiple Space Worlds. Wind Waker.
Ocarina was at least at 97 and 98. I don't know if it was at 96.
Wind Waker made a bunch of appearances at different events because
probably a video of Ocarina back when it was just called Zelda 64.
Yep.
Probably a video of it at E3 2000 or 1996.
Because we got to track the evolution of Link's eyes on Wind Waker as they kept changing the shape. But yeah, I think Majora is the only one that's not done a double since the series went to 3D. And I mean, it's just, these are big games. They take a long time to make. And it's hard to say that he's been a bad steward because ultimately there's only one game, one and a half games that have come out since then that I have real issues with. And it's really the last two 3D ones. And I don't think he was the lead director on Skyward Sword. I want to say it was that guy that was originally at Flagship that they picked up to do the 3D game. The DS game.
Onuma hasn't directed one in a while. Did he direct Twilight Princess?
I think he did. I think that was the last one he directed.
Okay. Because he's primarily the producer now. I mean, he's basically the Miyamoto of Zelda now.
Right.
Which now is a weird thought because Miyamoto is still around. But Miyamoto is much more of an executive producer at this point.
Right.
He's giving sort of minimal supervision, and Onuma is the producer full-time. He's there every day, but he's also managing multiple Zelda titles at any given time.
Yeah, it's Fujibayashi who is directing, at least directed Skyward Sword, and is probably in a similar position on this next game.
Mm.
I mean, that's one of the people that they pulled. Like I said, that's one of the guys they pulled from Flagship when Capcom shut that team down, because you don't need accomplished development teams around, do you, Capcom?
You know, I'll say that you've probably heard before that Ocarina, in a lot of ways, is almost a remake of Link to the Past. And Link to the Past is a very similar game to the first Zelda. It's just, you know, it's kind of like the huge generational leap. But it's very much sort of based on the template of the first game in that series. And in a lot of very basic structural ways, it is very similar to the original Legend of Zelda. So I think there's a lot to be said for the very hard turn that the series took when Onuma took over with Majora's Mask, which is that he had a very small amount of time and limited resources to make that game, and he had to reuse a lot of things from Ocarina. And so within that framework and those constraints, he made basically the most different thing that he possibly could with the same technology and a lot of the same assets.
Right.
And that was really the point at which Zelda started to incorporate a lot more of these really weird, interesting elements that I think have come to define it in a lot of ways over the past decade and a half, and for the most part in a very positive way. The series has become a lot more idiosyncratic since Majora's Mask. I mean, that game in particular, but yeah, a lot of those things even carried forward into the future. Wind Waker is, you know, a creatively, like a almost unprecedentedly bold thing to do with an established series. I mean, it's one of the like ballsiest things I can think of in the history of video games.
Imagine what the pitch was to, I guess it would, that still have been,
Yamauchi.
Yeah, it would have still been Yamauchi. Imagine the pitch of, we're going to make a Zelda game. It's going to be on the water. You're going to sit in a boat most of the game. Like, how the hell? It's gonna look like this. I mean, it's such a dramatic departure from what had been successful for them in both of the N64 games that it was like okay.
I mean, and Skyward Sword, I mean, for all the problems that we all have with it, I suppose, it is an amazing achievement. In they made a 40-hour game that uses motion controls in an extremely deep and integral way. And no one else has done that. Nobody else has done anything like that. There is no Kinect equivalent to Skyward Sword. Not even close.
Star Wars Kinect. What are you talking about?
Even in the Wii, there's not really that much. Well, right. You might have some that use the pointer, but not really movement.
And I guess the question that he's asking here is like, okay, you did it. Was that a good idea? I mean, I can't. My issues with Skyward Sword have nothing to do with the motion controls in general. My issues with that game are structural, and they're out there. You can go find the episode. We get real sad. I mean, it's a sad episode, but like,
You listen to him talk about the Wii U game, and the focus there is on the structure.
Right.
You know, like they want to do something radically different, and it probably won't have the most innovative control scheme ever. So. Yes, I think it's accurate to say that Onuma does kind of – he shifts his focus around pretty wildly from game to game, and he really focuses on different things every time he does it. But man, does it keep Zelda interesting after a very long time and a shitload of games in that series in a way that very few other franchises can say. And I'm very thankful for it, even though – you know, it doesn't always work out the best. I mean, we had to cut down Michael's email dramatically because it was enormous. But one of the things he said was that a lot of people would say their favorite game in the series was made by Onuma, and also a lot of people, and those same people might also say that their least favorite game in the series
Absolutely.
Was made under his watch. And I think, yeah, the games he's making are divisive because they take chances, they take big risks, and they try new things that other games, including other Zelda games, have not done before. And I would never try to take that away. I will settle for uneven quality and unpolished ideas in Zelda over a very polished experience that's basically the same thing every 2 or 3 years.
Well, and we have that with, I mean, I'm not trying to slam on other console manufacturers or the publishers, but you, I mean, you hear things like Uncharted where they just get more polished every time.
Yeah.
Well, people start to go like, man, or Assassin's Creed. They're just like, okay.
Yeah, that's the example I would have picked.
I get where you're at.
They do become more polished in a lot of ways, but
right,
you know, it's so incremental that who cares?
Yeah.
Yeah, and I don't think that it's not really desirable to have Zelda just every 2 or 3 years, like, okay, so you explore a mountain, and there's a lake, and there's a forest, well, see,
I don't know.
There's a castle, and there's a town.
If you could give me, you know, a really unique or entertaining Zelda experience every 2 years, absolutely I'd be on board with that. Like, we were getting that to a certain extent, but
it's really hard to pull off.
It is. Yeah.
And increasingly hard to pull off as games become more complex and more expensive to make. I just think, you know, when a new Zelda comes out, it is still an event. And Onuma's his way of handling the franchise is the reason that new Zelda games are still huge events where we really kind of don't know what to expect right up until when the game is finished and we get to play it for ourselves. And, man, there aren't that many exciting things left in the game industry on that scale. You know, with these big, giant, expensive, epic things like that, where you just walk in and you really don't know how it's going to turn out. And I cherish that, even when sometimes I come away disappointed. I think it's fantastic that they do that. But anyway, we'll have a lot of chance to talk about Onuma and 3D Zelda here pretty soon. So let's wrap up this episode with one final email that is near and dear to Donald's heart. So this email comes from John P., who writes, "I have to ask, who is Nintendo Free Radio and their relationship to you? Are they your doppelganger? And I am phasing between different timelines of the same universe?"
Okay. So,
Donald, who is Nintendo Free Radio?
Okay. We are the podcast that originally it started as a fill-in when RFN took a week off. Like, if you...
Which we're never allowed to do anymore.
Well, geez, we don't do it very often.
Yeah. So if you go back in the feed about 3 years or so, you can actually find our pilot episode in there. But we kept it going after that, and basically we're sort of the unofficial official podcast of the NWR forums. Like, we have game talk, we have, you know, the off-topic section, the what you watching section, and we get into some pretty deep discussions about games. But the reason we have the title is because of that whole fill-in thing. Because we were substituting for a week, we decided to, well, we flipped the name around literally, and that's how it ended up. I have thought about renaming the podcast at some point to get away from the connotation that we're ripping RFN off. But honestly, I can't find something that still works with the acronym.
I also think it's really hilarious, like the idea that you have a Nintendo podcast that's free of Nintendo.
Yes.
Although
I just like the idea that we've got our cover band.
Are you suggesting they're the Little Kiss of RFN?
Little Kiss. Jesus.
Green Hour.
Brit Floyd.
But it is its own show, and I don't listen to every episode, I have to confess, but I've listened to many of them, and you know, you guys have totally your own thing going, your own format, your own ideas, your own personalities, and if people are looking for another show with, you know, similar kinds of content, also a lot of anime talk, right?
Anime and comic books, much to my chagrin.
Well, that's the Nintendo free part, right?
Yeah.
They're also really long episodes, so if you wish RFN was like an extra hour every week.
Like the old days.
Yeah, back in them days, when we didn't do too much editing.
We didn't give a shit how long this show got.
Yeah, we record.
So it's 6 hours long? Great. Put it on the website.
Because we record every other weekend and sometimes every 3 weekends or so. Just there, I've had some personal issues as of late that have kind of slowed things down. So we're probably going to have a new episode out around the time this one does. And then we're also recording this weekend. So We will have plenty of content waiting for you. If I can sneak in a plug here, it's bit.ly/NFRadioPodcast or at NFR Podcast on Twitter.
But see, now that you're on staff, you can probably just do what we all did and just slide it on the website somewhere and be like, shh, don't
anybody look at this. And the articles for each episode are still posted in the NWR community forums, aren't they?
Right. They're in the general chat section. I have not yet used my staff powers to start stickying them, but it is tempting.
Yeah.
I mean, you might as well. I mean, I used to sticky.
You could.
I used to sticky ads for Israeli mud. I mean, do what you want, man.
So that's bit.ly/NFRradio.
bit.ly/NFRadioPodcast.
And Donald, what was the Twitter?
At NFR Podcast. Yeah.
So that's just the opposite of RFN Podcast.
Except I think we actually started ours first.
Probably. We only started ours like a week ago.
Yeah, ours is pretty fresh.
It's mostly just a place to retweet stuff that the other ones of us have said.
Yeah. Damn straight. Okay, well, yes, everybody should go listen to Nintendo Free Radio. It's a lot of fun. You can hear a lot more from Donald and his cohorts over there, and we recommend it. So thanks, everyone, for listening, and please send in your emails about anything that we talked about or didn't even have a chance to talk about on this very busy episode of the show. You can email us at rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. Before we go, I want to make sure everybody hears, if you didn't already see on our social media accounts on Facebook and Twitter, that the winner of the retroactive poll was indeed The Legend of Zelda Twilight Princess. So we are going to be talking more about that series and especially that particular game, which I think is one of the most interesting and most divisive games in that series. And apparently a lot of you did as well. So we are excited to start playing that. It's obviously a big game, one of the biggest games we've ever done for Retroactive. And so we're going to make sure we take our time and don't rush through it. We want to be able to discuss it very thoroughly. But I will kick off the forum thread here. By the time that you hear this episode, so you can certainly go and get started on the forums if you look at the article for this show, and we'll let you know about it a few more times here in the next month or so. Probably over a month we're going to take to play this because there are still, you know, other games coming too, a few at least. But if you would like to play along with us, we hope that you will. Of course, Twilight Princess is available both on GameCube and on Wii, and who knows, maybe it'll end up on Wii U pretty soon. That would be really nice, actually. It seems like a good candidate for it. But regardless, we're going to start playing it, and you should too. And you should start discussing the game with each other and with us over
Tell
the forums.
Tell us what handedness your link is.
That's what it's all about. Yeah, let's talk about handedness, baby. So thanks, everyone, for voting. It was the most votes we've ever gotten on Retroactive, and I'm really very, very pleased about that. It was actually a pretty close race between Zelda and Mario, Super Mario Sunshine, and Metroid Prime 2 picked up about 25%, so not that far behind either. So it ended up being a pretty close race, which is what I like to see, and I really, really do appreciate everybody who participated, and I hope you'll continue to participate as we play through Twilight Princess. And we'll talk about that sometime before E3, probably around mid to late May. We'll be doing the actual podcast feature on that. So we'll give you plenty of time to play it as well. That's all for this week. Thanks, everyone, again, for listening. Thank you, Donald, for subbing in. You were a great guest, as always, and we'll hear you on NFR and other things, and we'll be looking forward to your review here in about a month of of Devil Survivor 2 Overclocked or whatever the hell they're calling it.
And yeah, and I've somehow become the news guy as well, so I've got articles all over the website this week.
Sweet.
Oh dear. Hey Donald, what's your Twitter account? How can people follow what you're doing?
If you're looking to stalk me personally, I'm at Donald Mick. That's M-I-C-K for the second part.
Donald Mick on Twitter. Excellent. All right, that's it for this week. Thanks, everybody. We'll talk to you next time.
Peace. Bye.
Bye. It's the best part. Tell me when you're ready and we'll do a clapping. Yes. You're going to do clappings now?
Yes. Best part.
Excited about the clappings?
Best part.
Best part of clappings. Okay. Ready? No. Are you recording?
Yeah.
Okay. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Why did you clap on one?
I thought we clapped on one.
No, we clap on zero. We don't say zero, but we clap on zero.
Oh.
God damn it. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Amateurs. God. Anyway. Hey, it's Now Playing. I already have an intro. I do this every week. It's not necessary. Hi, John.
Hi, John.